Hey, welcome to Coin Talk. I'm Aaron Lammer. I'll be joined shortly by Jay Kang. Got a book club show for you today. This is part two, or volume two, of our reading of The Bitcoin Standard by Safedin Amous. I really am enjoying the book. We're going to talk about chapters, I think, 4 through 7. We are also brought to you in partnership with Medium. Medium has tons of great writing on crypto. You can find it all at me.dm/crypto. Consider becoming a member. It's $5 a month, and it helps support great programs, shows, projects like this one. Okay, play the music.
This episode of Coin Talk was taped Tuesday, May 29th at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Bitcoin price index was $7,495.
Jay, welcome.
Yo, what's up?
Oh, I would be in remiss if I didn't say two things. One, show's not investment advice. That goes for every episode of this show.
Wait, and did we get a note from a lawyer that says we have to say this at the top of every show?
No, I just, anytime I remember it, I say it. It's okay. like a Catholic prayer.
The Coin Talk lawyer has weighed in.
You ready for some book club?
Yeah.
Is this your first book club? Like the book club that you and I are in here? Have you been in a book club before?
I've never been in a book
club. I've never been in a book club either. I'm actually, I would say, violently against book clubs.
Generally. I have a question. Is it a book club if it's two people?
Yes.
No, it's definitely not a book club.
It's a book club.
That is two friends reading a book.
For starters, it's not just us. It's the thousands and thousands of listeners in us.
I feel like it needs some sort of snack element, and it needs to be like people who want to hang out but don't ever hang out, who are drawn together by a book. That doesn't apply for any of us.
Well, I would at least say this is an e-book club, okay, like lowercase e dash uppercase b book club, e-book club. And we thank all the listeners out there for making this duo an army. Shout out to the Coin Talk world out there, Coin Talk Nation.
Is that your way of trying to make Coin World catch on?
I'm just going to keep pushing Coin World.
But for those who don't know, last week, Aaron and I went and we recorded a podcast with our friends from Lifehacker.
Yeah, The Upgrade.
The Upgrade. And Aaron tried to make this phrase Coin World stick the entire podcast. I know.
It was fantastic because they were like, the first question was like, what is Bitcoin? And within like 30 seconds, I had shilled Sumo and tried to get Coin World to happen.
Does CoinTalk LLC have Coin World trademarked?
If not, we should definitely.
Okay, as long as I'm like, cut in on this, I'm fine with Coin
World. I'm going to say that the long-term vision of Coin World is that eventually it's an amusement park outside Orlando in which you can like take a like hologram tour through crypto history.
Or you can take a ride in the Bitcoin and Ethereum Aston Martins.
Yeah, you can talk to like Wizard of Oz style, talk to Satoshi.
Talk to Satoshi. There's like a roller coaster that's like the price of Bitcoin.
Yes.
Is that meme come to life?
That's the kind of sharp catches I'm looking for.
Thank you.
So the reason I've never been in a book club, I don't even need to ask why you've never been in a book club, because your personality at a book club,
it'd be terrible.
I imagine you would walk out of the first meeting in a huff.
I would either say nothing and leave 20 minutes in, or I would become horrible and I would start lecturing everybody.
The idea of reading fiction in a group and then like being subject to other adults, like opinion, like my parents had a book club, and I would always hear people talking about how they like did or did not like the characters in the book. That's pretty much all they talked about. Yeah. I'd blow a fuse.
Yeah, well, that's why you and I are in a basement right now in our late 30s and are talking about Bitcoin.
Yeah.
That's exactly why.
Yeah, we've been reduced to this.
All right, so this book.
Let's pick up with chapter 4.
Okay.
Here, I'm going to flip to it here. Chapter 4, I believe, is government money.
Should we recap a little bit?
To recap last week's, we talked a lot about the history of stores of value, the history of gold, basically how people have been trying to make money out of objects since time, not immemorial, but for quite a while.
So some of these examples were like wampum, which was a bunch of shells. I think it was a type of shell that Native Americans used as currency, or an island. I forget where. I think it was off the coast of Ireland or something like that, where they had big stones with circles in the middle of it. And all these things have been used as currencies in the past. And for reasons that Safedin Amus explains, they became flooded. So somebody figured out a way to dredge a bunch of wampum off the ocean floor, I think, and that flooded that market. So that currency was devalued. And it was his way of saying that you need a currency that can't have a massive influx of new currency coming in to devalue it, because that screws up all sorts of things.
Yeah, I think that one of the examples that comes up not only in that chapter, but across the book, is this colonial example of African societies where like cowrie beads were traded, and then European traders came in and used the mass production of cowrie beads that was available to them and ships to basically take all of the existent wealth out of the country in exchange for a bunch of cowrie beads, which rapidly became worthless because of the influx of cowrie beads by the colonial invaders.
Yeah, white people.
Yeah, I mean, I would say this whole book is white people.
It's a lot of shy white people in this book.
Well, it's always a little hard to read some of the politics in this book, too, because Safedin Amus is Lebanese, I believe, which is one of the more complicated. Like, I don't even know. Someone who's Lebanese could come from many, many backgrounds.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is our obligatory shout-out to Nassim Taleb,
yep.
Also very complicated.
Also Lebanese.
And right? Lebanese, yeah. Yeah. He wrote about it quite a bit in The Black Swan, which I still maintain is a good book, even though Nassim has blocked me on Twitter.
Hopefully we can have a Truth and Reconciliation episode in which Nassim Taleb ceremonially unblocks you on the show. But talking about government money, so we pick up this story at the tail end of the gold standard. So we're talking World War One era, early 20th century here.
Yeah, and we want to, I want to at least emphasize that it was at this point in the book where it really becomes a polemic, right? The first part is sort of a accounting of history, and this part is when he starts really making arguments. And one of the arguments that he makes is that World War One became World War One not because necessarily this conflict between, like, you know, like a Serbian separatist group and whoever had so many ties to everybody else that they all got drawn in. You know, like, I think when you and I are probably in history class, there was probably some sort of like weird flow chart that showed why World War One happened from the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand.
I don't even remember the why. I just remember the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand.
Do you remember that because of the band, or do you remember that because of history class?
I think I remember it just because I like that story.
Yeah, it's like the defenestration of Prague, which I vaguely remember.
I think also, didn't Franz Ferdinand's assassin pee his pants before he shot him?
I have no idea.
I think he peed his pants, and people were like, look at that man, he's peed his pants!
That's something
and
that you
left out and shot him.
That might have been on the curriculum at Berkeley High School, but was not at Chapel Hill High School.
So this did dovetail with things that we've talked about before on the show that I didn't totally understand. So one of the arguments about moving away from fiat money and towards crypto is that it will stop the war machine. That if individual citizens can choose to fund or not fund wars, we will have less wars. And I think we've generally mocked that argument or found it somewhat specious. And I think he makes a decent case here that first, that the break with the gold standard generally occurs during a war. Well, most people are on the gold standard up until they're in the war, and then they print a bunch of money to fund the war.
Yeah, so he does explain it here. I have it right here. Let's hear it. This is about World War One. Within a few weeks of the war starting, all major belligerents had suspended gold convertibility, effectively going off the gold standard and putting their population on a fiat standard, wherein the money they used was government-issued paper that was not redeemable for gold. With a simple suspension of gold redeemability, government's war efforts were no longer limited to the money that they had in their own treasuries, but extended virtually to the entire wealth of the population. For as long as the government could print more money and have that money accepted by its citizens and foreigners, it could keep financing the war. Previously, under a monetary system where gold as money was in the hands of the people, government only had its own treasuries to sustain its war effort, along with any taxation or bond issues to finance the war. So that seems to be a clear argument saying that, like, At some point, if you have a limited store of money or you have a limited amount of money, at some point that money runs out, right?
Yep.
At some point, you and I sitting here, or you and I in our apartments are like, okay, we'll give this, this, and this to the war. You know, like we'll give our baby high chairs, we'll give a certain ration of like Cheerios, we'll give a certain ration, we'll give up this appliance, right? Our dishwashers can go. But at some point...
Yeah, I think the war effort really wants your Soda Stream, Jay.
It's a very loaded Soda Stream thing. But at some point, you're just like, actually, I'm not going to give you my Soda Stream. And then people stop giving money to the war. And the government can't fund the war anymore because the public has said no more, right?
Yes.
That can't happen when there's deflation of currency. It can only happen when the government can print more money.
This concept has always been a little confusing to me because... It makes out like in a Bitcoin maximalist world that individual citizens are just going to vote constantly with their checkbook, that they're just going to say yay or nay to everything the government does. And I can tell you, I'm the head of a small co-op.
You are? Oh, yeah, that's right.
We're sitting in it right now.
Yeah, we are. I always wonder what types of graft you like that you're like, involved in. As the head of a co-op.
I'm the Keynesian manager here. I'm like, not everyone's going to agree on anything. We have to move forward as a group. And I think a direct democracy, whether it's a war-torn Bitcoin wasteland or it's Occupy Wall Street, I think there's a lot of problems with everyone having a vote on everything. And I don't really understand how this idea is going to work in practice. I understand his counter argument, which is that inflationary currencies make it really easy to go to war. I'm not sure I totally wrap my head around why a deflationary currency would stop war unless literally there's some sort of a system. And the only thing I can think of that's sort of working this way now is, are you familiar at all with the Five Star Movement in Italy?
No.
Google Five Star Movement. I'm not encouraging people to get into it, but basically it's a political party in Italy that has a central computer called Rousseau that's controlled by this one guy. God. They just started to control the Italian parliament.
Sure.
And Bitcoin is supposedly spiking this morning on the news of them forming this government because all the Italian bonds went way down. But basically it's like a form of direct democracy in which people in the party vote for who they're going to run and various other things using this computer. And most people think that the guy who controls the computer is secretly controlling the entire party, though he is not a politician himself. I think it's a fascinating story.
So it's
story.
Like an Oz guy?
Kind of, yeah.
Or is it like a guy who is kind of like Milton from Office Space, and he's like, oh, I'm just the custodian of the computer, but actually he's the guy who controls the whole thing.
That's basically what it is. I think it's actually the son of the guy who started the party. He's like this, like a computer scientist that no one knows about.
Okay.
But Five Star Movement is not decentralized, leading to widespread suspicions of the person who's running it. Even if it was decentralized, it's a little hard for me to imagine direct democracy stopping war. But I do find the idea of inflationary currencies perhaps encouraging wars to be a compelling one.
Okay. So here's the way that I saw it breaking down, right? Which is essentially that at some point, the government is going to come in and take my Soda Stream anyway, right? Like, that would be the argument that somebody would say.
Yes.
Being like, I can't just say no if they come in and take it.
Well, if they come in and try and tax you and you don't pay, eventually they're going to take your bank account and
exactly.
then your Soda Stream.
Exactly. And his argument would be like, those types of, that is actually much harder to implement on a population because they're going to resist that harder than that they're going to resist some arbitrary inflationary currency tax increase, if that makes sense.
Yes.
And so, like, you can trick the populace into believing you're not jacking them to do this war for longer if you have an inflationary currency. If you have a gold standard currency and every single loss is felt immediately, then essentially the pain of taxation is going to be much clearer to the public.
Yeah, which I think starts to come into the stuff that I want to talk about in the second part of this episode around time preference and how people are thinking about money over time. One of the things I thought was cool in this chapter was to read, like, part of the reason that these inflationary currencies are dangerous in a war situation is not just that you can print more money and inflate your currency, your adversary can do the same, and it becomes something of a money-burning competition, like in the World War I case, where it's like, well, we have to inflate our currency to build a bigger war machine to fight their bigger war machine, and it can lead to a situation of mutually assured destruction.
Sure, that's his argument. I mean, he basically, in this chapter, says that every massive conflict from World War One on was the result of going off of the gold standard.
Pretty much, yeah.
And I found that to be difficult to swallow. But he does make, I mean, look, he's a good polemicist in that sort of way. He's not doing half-baked takes here, right? He's basically doing Skip Bayless of economics.
There was a few takes I found a little undercooked with
like
some raw meat. Maybe I'll get to it when we pass that part.
Okay.
His writing about art is not the writing of someone who knows very much about art.
Yeah, actually. I would agree with that. We can get there. But look, if you look at all into this, there's a lot of people who would argue that this sort of Mises school, that's the Austrian school thinking, and the ways in which they construct these narratives, that generally they're built almost on conspiracy theories, right? That this is not how the war effort was funded. There's a lot of pushback. I would encourage anyone who is part of our book club to look at that. I read a couple of them, and look, it like the idea that essentially the government's made a conscious decision at that point to be like, holy shit, now we can do it. That's always a bit troubling to me. But then again, there's like, have you read The Shock Doctrine?
I have not.
The Naomi Klein book. There's this part where like it starts and it's about Hurricane Katrina, right? And that a lot of people who are pro charter schools realize that this disaster was necessary for them to implement a massive regime change all at once. And that they used Katrina to turn the entire New Orleans school system into charter schools, basically. So, and, you know, Naomi Klein is much more thorough than Safadine Amos, and I tend to trust her history a little bit more. So there are points where these sorts of things happen. The thing that I found less convincing about this is that the entire world collectively decided at once, hey, now is the time to go off the gold standard, and let's do it so that we can fund these wars forever and destroy one another. There's no real like motive there, you know? And certainly that I find the motives for World War One that are more historically accepted to be a little bit more convincing.
Yeah, I mean, I like the book, so I don't want to shit on it. But he cites the example that is like, come on, man, this is just as cliche as the tulips thing about the soldiers crossing the lines and playing soccer on Christmas Eve, which is like the one scene in every movie set during the war. And he uses that to extrapolate that the soldiers all really liked each other and there was no actual conflict between them, which is like, I don't know, bro. There's a little more complexity. I mean, even as a like an extreme amateur historian, I don't totally buy that there's like that like ethnic tensions did not contribute to the First World War.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is essentially, I mean, it's like he is in a lot of ways a pure market economist, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he believes that there is no input or output that you can't see within economic decisions made by the state. And his conclusion from this is that the state should make no economic decisions at all.
The most interesting chart in this chapter I found was the chart of all of these European currencies against the Swiss franc in the 1910s. Basically, everyone wrecked themselves against the Swiss franc during the 1910s. So I think he's right that the Swiss strategy there is probably better for your currency. Now, if you're a Jew in 1940s Europe, you might not appreciate the Swiss strategy of banking everyone and not giving a shit.
Sure.
Like, I sort of agree with his standpoint that if you resist the urge to inflationary currency printing, your currency will probably perform well against the people who are printing all of that currency.
Yeah, to try and save their countries.
I don't feel like everyone can do that at once. And that is something I do think about Bitcoin and crypto maximalism is it's very different to put the world on a standard versus to put like Switzerland on a standard. It's always made sense to have this banking enclave that serves war criminals and honorable people alike.
Sure. Like,
that's always made sense from a financial standpoint. But what would happen if all of Europe were to embrace a Swiss style government? I don't know.
From war, he goes on to explain sort of Keynesian economics, right? Should we talk about that next?
I mean, I'm going to just out myself as a really ignorant person here and say, like, many of the things he says are Keynesian economics. I just took as generally accepted economic thought.
But that's his argument, right?
Yeah.
That now Keynesian, like, it's almost like a Borges story where one idea takes over the world because of the symmetry that it provides, and that because the world essentially collapses around the thrall of one idea, and that idea might be bad.
Yes.
And that's what his argument is. So he lays it out here too, and this will be a much shorter passage, but he says, this is after Keynes comes out and makes his argument, and he goes to great pains to say that Keynes is not a real economist, and, you know, sort of paints him as a charlatan, and
he likes the personal attack on the economist.
The Keynesian deluge from which the world is yet to recover had begun. Universities lost their independence and became part and parcel of the government's ruling apparatus. Academic and economics stopped being an intellectual discipline focused on understanding human choices under scarcity to improve their conditions. Instead, it became an arm of the government meant to direct policymakers towards the best policies for managing economic activities. So he is essentially saying that what governments were waiting for was an ideology that would allow them to escape the tyranny of the gold standard, that was actually a more direct democracy that allowed people to have some sort of personal freedom to do things like say, hey, if you take my soda stream, I'm going to have a gun here and I'm going to shoot whoever comes through that door. He's saying that essentially the entire world thinking changed because of this.
Yeah, I mean, and he paints it as sort of a international conspiracy that not only were these ideas implemented, but a larger apparatus was to put in place to make people think that this was the only solution to economies.
Okay, and throughout this entire period, right, Aaron, like, and this is something I wanted to ask you, which was like, he does not mention for many, many pages the words Bitcoin, right?
Yeah.
Like, so did you draw the parallels through this part as to why these were arguments for Bitcoin?
I am glad you brought this up, because one of the things that I was thinking while I was reading this was, crypto people are always giving gold bugs shit on Twitter. Like, yeah. No one argues more on Twitter than gold bugs and cryptomaniacs.
Yeah.
And if you read this chapter, you would think that gold bugs and cryptomaniacs should get along with each other and be supporting each other. In many ways, he's basically just saying Bitcoin is 21st century gold. And he's advocating for going on to the Bitcoin standard like we used to be on the gold standard. And part of me wondered why we even need Bitcoin so desperately, if we could just, like, gold seems almost as good in this worldview.
Yeah, I had the same thought.
Other than
like,
the portability issues. But it seems like now with all of the, like, Amazon one day delivery, send the gold over here. Send them two flakes.
Yeah, exactly.
Two flakes for you.
Yeah. I kind of felt the same way. I was like, man, this is a great argument for gold, you know? And I don't know if we need to adopt Bitcoin and all of its attendant problems at this point. Like, why not just go back on the gold standard? If that's every argument he is making in this book is an argument to go back on the gold standard. And maybe we haven't gotten to the point why we can't do that. But I don't understand how Bitcoin is just a perfect corollary to the gold standard.
Well, one difference is that when we had the gold standard, gold was held in national reserves, and then we printed currency based on it.
Sure.
I don't think that the Bitcoin standard is advocating for the U.S. government holding Bitcoin and then printing fiat currency backed by Bitcoin. I think that Bitcoin maximalism is hold your own keys. Everyone's got their own money. So those are pretty different outcomes. There's one sentence that really caught my eye here. He's talking about the shift towards Keynesian thinking.
Yeah.
It says, central planning sought to achieve what the gold standard had achieved spontaneously. So he's basically saying that the gold standard, everyone just spontaneously organized themselves into a efficient, frictionless economic system, and that central planning has to do all this work. And it struck me that part of this libertarian worldview isn't simply that we need to achieve a specific outcome, but that we need to do so through spontaneous human principles and organic growth. That part of the power of Bitcoin is that for people who think this way, that people don't have to be told to do this, that people spontaneously choose to do so.
Sure.
And that was something I hadn't really thought of as a major part of the appeal of Bitcoin to people who maybe would have been into gold 100 years ago.
You and I, just to lay a few things bare, right?
Yeah.
We're from very similar backgrounds and that we both grew up in ultra-liberal college towns, right? Yeah. Our politics probably reflect...
You're Korean, I'm Samoan.
Yeah. Look, I'm trying to be race blind. Our show is now, we don't see color. We don't see race. We have, our politics generally reflect a lot of those backgrounds, right?
Yeah.
Did you find this, this is pretty hard right thinking, and it's not hard right socially, but it's certainly hard right economically, and is affiliated with people like, you know, like with Ron Paul, for example. Like,
yeah, he's definitely the first person I heard advocating for a gold standard.
Yeah, and do you find this to be repelling at all in your interest in Bitcoin, this sort of laying out of Austrian school economics?
You know, it didn't bother me at this point, but it bothered me later, so I'll say when it bothered me. But once it started bothering me, I'm able to see, like, I don't know enough about economics to be offended by some of these ideas, but I do know enough about art. And then when I see the way that he writes about art, it makes me go, oh,
okay, I can't wait to get to the art section.
Were these economics like dumb and simplistic is the way you're writing about art? Cause I wouldn't know. I mean, honestly, I know that you say like we have similar politics, et cetera, but I haven't politics and particularly as they pertain to economic policies is really not something that I have focused my life on.
Sure. And I only started thinking about it because I was writing an article that never came out about Dread Pirate Roberts. And Dread Pirate Roberts, Ross Ulbricht, went to the Ludwig von Mises Academy for part of his education. So he was very hardcore into this, and it actually makes sense that he was one of the early Bitcoiners, right?
Yeah.
Because of that. And I remember at the time thinking that, you know, like, I don't like people telling me what to do in general, you know? And I felt like this was probably...
Wait, you don't like people telling you what to do?
Yeah, I really don't.
Is that you ended up in a book club of two?
Yeah. In a basement with the president of the co-op of the building. But I did find parts of it appealing, but essentially in the end, all of the logic is essentially about accumulation and why accumulation is good, right? And why we should incentivize smart people to accumulate more. Yeah. And that is, and look, there's always a downside to this. We talked about this when we talked about Decentral and the Jax Liberty coin or whatever, which is that essentially this guy's vision for the world is that people who have the Jax Liberty coin are going to profit and live in this wonderful utopia of prepaid cards and weird stadiums in which they all sit and watch like no game, right? Whatever his vision was. And that everyone else who doesn't do it, then screw them. And I found a lot of that in Safadin's book to this point that we're at right now, right? Which is that even he discusses the Stanford marshmallow test quite a bit, right?
Yeah.
And he says
another story that appears in every single argument.
Yeah.
About anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the marshmallow thing for people who haven't read it is you've heard this story before. A bunch of kids are gathered together. They're told you can have a treat now, or if you wait 15 minutes, I'm going to come back. And everyone who hasn't eaten their treat gets two treats.
Yeah. And then they tracked all the kids and they found that the kids who essentially said, all the kids who waited for the second treat generally had higher SAT scores, did better in life.
Well, I think the three things he cited were SAT score, body mass index, and drug addiction. Yes, they were. I have the quote here. Yeah. Hold on. Hold on, listeners. Those who could wait did better on the SAT, had lower body mass index, and lacked addiction to drugs. So I brought this up because I personally, no one better illustrates the kid who eats the treat than me.
How'd you do on the
SAT? Of those three things, only one of them's off. I did very well on the SAT. I've not done well on low body mass index. I don't know which kind of drugs. I mean, I don't know if they're counting weed in there.
You host a weed podcast.
I host a weed podcast. So I guess maybe they're right on some of these things.
Holy shit. Well, okay. I did pretty well on the SAT. My body mass index fluctuates wildly.
Yeah.
You know, I...
Gambling's a drug, Jay.
If gambling is a drug, then I'm fucked. I would have taken that marshmallow immediately.
Gambling is a hell of a drug.
Yeah, it really is.
Also, I've always heard that story as like a cookie. Do you think like marshmallow is the like Lebanese variant on that experiment?
No, I think it was always a marshmallow.
Really?
But
I feel like it's got to be a higher value treat than a marshmallow. Like, oh, you got one marshmallow.
Kids
or
love
two
marshmallows.
Who cares? That's not enough marshmallows. Now, if we're talking about like a slice of cake.
So you would have immediately, you would go even further. You would not only eat the marshmallow immediately, but you would pound on the window and be like, I would like a slice of cake. So you and I both scoring, I think what he would say, Aaron,
yes,
is that you and I, as both people who would clearly have failed the Stanford marshmallow experiment, I don't think there's any doubt about this.
There's no passing or failing. It's to learn. I became an SAT instructor after eating the marshmallow.
Who did you instruct?
Did some Princeton Review over there in the East Bay.
Really?
Yeah. So that, the whole marshmallow thing is actually a pretty good introduction to the idea of time preference, which is a big thing in why you might think the going to a Bitcoin standard or going off of the fiat world would be a good idea. Time preference is basically about whether you are a short or a long-term thinker with regards to value. So
you and I are short-term.
I'm actually kind of long, I think. Because I like to do I make a podcast and it doesn't make any money for the first couple of years, and then it starts making money because it builds up an audience.
Yeah, you also like sell the bottom and
in crypto?
Yeah, sell the bottom and buy the top.
Oh, in crypto
all the time, and you have like 20 shit coins.
In crypto, I'm extremely high time preference. Yeah. In life, I'm a little lower time preference. So he gives the example of two people, and it takes a day to fish to get enough food. You can either just keep fishing to get your food, or you can build a fishing rod, which you lose some of your fishing time, but then you can fish more efficiently, which means that you have more extra time in your day. And now that you've built a fishing rod, you can build a boat. Yeah. Eventually you build a boat fleet. And this also relates to how wealth passes across generations and how people regard money. And his overall point is, if you think your money is going to be valuable in the future, you will probably have a low time preference. If you think your money is going to devalue fast, YOLO. High time preference. Spend that shit.
Yeah, and his argument then is that if you are the person who is taking 2 hours out of each fishing day to build a fishing rod to plan for the future, you can't be incentivized if you believe that the fish are going to run out.
Yeah.
Or that the entire world is not going to exist that is going to make you profit from your own enterprise.
Yeah. Isn't this also kind of like a moralistic, idle hands are the devil's work kind of argument?
Yeah, but that's why I was saying that he's judging us for being bad at the Stanford marshmallow test, you know?
Yeah.
Like, all of this is moralizing, basically saying that you and I as a highly impulsive people are idiots.
I know that I'm bad at it. Every
page, I was like, this guy thinks I'm an idiot.
Yeah.
You know? he looks at my 5-team parlay that I just laid on baseball and is like, man, that guy is really dumb. And I'm like, listen, I hit one of these 6 months ago.
Well, it was interesting that this idea of time preference comes up in a book about crypto, because under these ideas, crypto people should be the ultimate high time preferencers, right? That's why you would want to buy a deflationary currency. But in practice, I mean, maybe not Bitcoin maximalists, but I haven't exactly seen like a lot of high time preference activity in crypto. I've seen a lot of people chasing fast money, and I indict myself here. A lot of people starting in Bitcoin, getting into alts, thinking they could even get more Bitcoin more quickly, and generally turbocharging the whole thing.
Yeah, but Savadin, to be fair, half of his Twitter presence is hating those people.
That's true. That's true.
And like, that's why he thinks that every coin, including Ethereum, is a shit coin and it should go away, because it is deflecting from Bitcoin's true vision of being the one deflationary world economy.
I think that makes sense, and those two things align with each other. I do think it slightly undercuts what we've learned from human psychology in crypto to say, oh, it's deflationary, so everyone's just going to hold on to it and save it and not spend it. I think what we've actually seen is that people are very interested in short-term profits and are also very willing to sell when the time is right, you know?
Yeah, I don't think that's a problem for him. I think he would say those people are all dumb and they're all hurting themselves. And what you should do is you should just buy a little bit of Bitcoin every single week or something like that so that you keep accumulating.
Yeah, I mean, hodling is high time preference activity. Yeah. Like, hodl forever is basically saying become a high time preference wizard.
And, you know, and it was, I actually am. To play the other side, Aaron, I'm actually much more sympathetic to him in these moments.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like if you believe in Bitcoin, you really think that it is going to change the world, that you need to actually just keep, oh, the only thing you should ever do is accumulate Bitcoin, and that you shouldn't look at it as a fast track thing. Yeah. You should look at it as real estate, you know, like physical real estate for a new world order. And I...
Wait, physical real estate?
What do you mean? Well, you know, like it is essentially you are charting out part of, you are mapping out these keys occupy this percentage of the new world economy, and I am going to keep it forever, and I'm only going to be increasing it bit by bit by bit, right? It's like hoarding gold, for example. Like, I'm glad that he goes full maximalist on this, and the examples that he gives, I think, are essentially right. I do think they are moralistic, but I think the moral that he's trying to say is that if you're into Bitcoin, be into Bitcoin. You know, be into it for these reasons because you believe these things, and don't be into it just because it's like a cool thing and you think it's going to build a few cool apps, and Ethereum is going to build some D apps, and it's going to create like some sort of new Google, and you can be part of that new Google. He's saying, no, actually, the entire world is fucked because of fiat currency and it went off the gold standard. We have an opportunity to reclaim the world economy, and you can do it by buying Bitcoin. That actually is like a gospel that I don't agree with, but I can identify as being a heartfelt and sincere gospel.
If you live in a country that's functional and prosperous and the government does a good job of managing that economy, I think you'd probably want to stay there. If you're in Sweden right now, I would not try and overthrow the government if you're living in Sweden right now. Pretty chill over there. If you're living in Venezuela, you may feel more pull to the Austrian school. And your interest in replacing your wealth, moving your wealth from your local fiat to Bitcoin, I think gets higher and higher depending on how shitty the government of where you live is.
I agree. But I think Safadin would argue that those of us who don't feel like we're in Venezuela have wool over eyes and we're all in Venezuela, because any place that has government-controlled currency is a totalitarian state to him.
Yeah, and I mean, I would ask the questions, how much does your government suck, and how much future sucking do you expect? Based on that basic premise, I'm not surprised that a crypto bull run occurred in the first year of the Trump presidency. For me, I get closer and closer to this thinking the more I think America's fucked no matter what, regardless of what school of economics I'm in.
Yeah, yeah. That's where you and I are aligned. We're aligned on almost nothing in terms of buying crypto and the value of crypto, but we're completely aligned in that we are only interested in crypto because we fear the apocalypse, right? Would Bitcoin, the fact that Bitcoin reliably, like you said this morning even, right? Like the fact that Bitcoin prices in specific countries that are under severe economic or political duress, the fact that it spikes every single time when that happens, I mean, that is something, you know, and that is something that people should think about. And even if you hate Bitcoin, you should acknowledge at least that there is a correlative effect at this point.
And, you know, he writes that and I think he's talking about me and you, are the first generation in the Western world since the demise of the Roman Empire to come into the world with less capital than their parents.
Yeah.
This is a profound idea. People have basically been assuming that each generation has a better life and more capital and is able to do more things than their parents did. And even if that retracts one time out of 50 generations, that could shatter the entire world.
Yeah.
I don't think it's just Trump. I mean, crypto predates Trump, but I think the general feeling that the world is spinning into chaos is a bullish sign for Bitcoin. And I also think it's always felt like the world is spinning into chaos, which maybe makes this kind of a historical development seductive. And then he started writing about art, and then I was like, I don't know. Okay, so he starts writing about, he's basically saying that wealthy patrons would want to commission artwork, like say the Sistine Chapel, because it would outlive them. In the same way capital outlives you, these artistic expressions, and that the artists who made them were master craftsmen who knew that their work had to stand the test of time. Similarly, the musical works of Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, and the composers of the Renaissance, classical, and romantic eras put to shame today's animalistic noises recorded in batches of a few minutes, churned out by the ton by studios profiting from selling to man the titillation of his basest instincts. First of all, Jay, would you like to line edit that sentence a little bit with me?
No, I don't. No. No, thank you. I pass.
Titillations.
Is there an assistant editor that I can pass this off to?
What word would you replace titillations with?
I think that I would circle the whole thing and I would say, I think we could go without this paragraph about art.
Whereas the music of the golden era spoke to man's soul and awakened him to think of higher callings than the mundane grind of daily life, today's musical noises speak to man's most base animalistic instincts, distracting him from the realities of life by inviting him to indulge in immediate sensory pleasures with no concern for long-term consequences or anything more profound. I feel like he's talking about like meth, not music here.
Or I think that this is all just like a, you know, like boy bands and pop music is terrible.
This strikes me as like the writings of a person who has a free Pandora account.
Yeah.
Come on, man. First of all,
look, it's ahistorical, first of all.
This is
right?
Exactly how people wrote about art during the Renaissance. They were like, this is some barbaric animal shit.
And it's also thoroughly ahistorical. Like Mozart, the Magic Flute is written as a lowbrow comedy that was playing because he needed money, you know? Like a lot of Mozart's operas are vulgar things that were played in basically beer halls because he needed money. Dostoevsky wrote books because he was in gambling debt. That a lot of the books were about a character in gambling debt. They are not very good books. They are things that were created exactly for the reasons that he said. The idea that these artists back then were somehow sitting around and touched by God because they knew that they had to outlive their own lives it's insanely ahistorical. Every time someone makes this type of argument, I go crazy because it essentially takes the artist out of his context and makes him into like a pulsing brain that is only existing to create the great art that you consider great right now. It's not true. A lot of these people are people, just like anybody else's people. You put out a bad album from time to time. Some of your albums are good, you know?
People have been trying to make great transcendent art since people have been able to draw on caves. Like, I know musicians. They are not being titillated by the base instincts of demanded by suits. It's also funny to be like, oh, it's all of these like studios and labels just churning it out. Like, dude, you know that there's no money. Like, yeah. No one is churning out music
that shit's
for
gone.
The dough.
Yeah.
But even his example of the Renaissance, I'm reading right now this book about Caravaggio. And so what all these patrons
were
doing?
Caravaggio book club?
Caravaggio book club of one. All of these quote unquote patrons who are like seeking higher whatever. These guys were all just gambling speculators.
Oh, yeah.
They were commissioning art, pumping it, being like, Caravaggio is the shit. In a couple years, you won't be able to get one of these Caravaggios for under 1,000 scudi. The money that they use then is called the scudi, or the scuddy.
It's the most esoteric.
And they're like horse trading the shit out of these paintings with each other, particularly in a particularly Bitcoinian twist, because paying someone a bunch of money who's like your cardinal would be considered sinful, but getting some political concessions and giving him a religious painting that might or might not be worth a ton of money, totally acceptable. These were people who wanted to pass generational wealth on, not people who are seeking transcendent godly art.
Yeah, it's just like the art market now. It was money laundering.
Yeah. Art is the greatest. Like, if you want to understand Bitcoin, study art history. It's all been a giant pump and dump scheme.
So is that what Safedin was trying to do in this part?
No, he was trying to say that people used to like have these higher time preference ideas of art, that art used to be based on a higher time preference, and now it's just people's base instinct. And then he gets on to modern art.
He's like talking about the Yin Yang Twins whisper song here.
Here, I'm going to read a little bit of his takes on modern art. A stroll through a modern art gallery shows artistic works whose production requires no more effort or talent than could be mustered by a bored six-year-old. Modern artists have replaced craft and long hours of practice with pretentiousness, shock value, indignation, and existential angst as ways to cow audiences into appreciating their art, and often added some pretense to political ideals, usually of the puerile Marxist variety, to pretend play profundity.
Okay, I mean, I'm with him fully through this. I agree with almost everything he just said.
Well, okay, a couple things. If you're going to shit on modernism and postmodernism, which Kang will join you for.
Oh, no.
you should at least note that all of these artistic movements that you're shitting on are caused by the same technological shifts that you're writing about with regard to the gold standard. Why did art become consumerist? Because America is consumerist. These things aren't happening in a vacuum. People aren't like, I have got a great get-rich-quick scheme, abstract art.
Well, like, I mean, look, he and many other people right now, right? Like, they're traditionalists. And every argument that he's making is a traditionalist argument. And for economics, he wants to go back to essentially, like, the 1910s or 1890s. And for art, he wants to go back, I guess, to like the 1550s or something like that.
Yeah.
It is all this nostalgic.
1600-ish.
It's all this nostalgic looking back at great times. It's the same thing that these like sort of identity Europa guys do about Western civilization by looking at statues. And they say, we need to restore the glory of Western civilization. It is a very hazy, ahistorical looking back at it. And I will, you know, this is all a pretense of like, we are doing this book club. But I found that all to be predictable and boring in the same way that I find the identity Europa arguments to be about Western civilization to be predictable and boring.
I feel like he is bending the truth to fit into this neat bucket that he's built. And I didn't notice when he was talking about economics, I don't know jack shit about economics. I know a little bit about art history. And the part about art history is so patently wrong that it's even wrong if you have the most conservative worldview. You're just simply wrong about how art works.
Well, that's what I mean. It's ahistorical. He's saying things that were not true about art at the time.
He's talking about basically the National Endowment for Arts and the way that in a planned economy, the government commissions art. And he says, when government is in charge of deciding winners and losers, the sort of people who have nothing better to do with their life than work as government bureaucrats are the arbiters of taste and beauty. Instead of art success being determined by the people who have succeeded in attaining wealth through several generations of intelligence and low time preference, it is instead determined by the people with the opportunism to rise in the political and bureaucratic system best. That is a bonkers thing to say. For starters, intelligence is not carried across generations. Anyone who went to a fancy private school can tell you about how much intelligence is like passed along with wealth across generations. Furthermore, very little of the Art America is funded by the government, like a preposterously small amount of the art. And none of the taste in art in America is decided by the government.
No, it's funded by the not smart kids at the private school.
It's funded by all the people who are like profiteering across generations from collecting art.
Yeah. Yeah. Like it is literally that kid who you're like, wow, that kid is a Rockefeller, or that kid is like a Vanderbilt and he's at school. And then you're like, wow, that kid is an idiot. And then they become an art history major and then they're running the family's art trust at the age of 28. And those are the people who fund art.
The only market for art is people who inherited wealth. Inherited wealth or attained wealth through the management of other people's money who inherited wealth.
Yeah.
Those are the two people who buy $1 million plus artworks.
And now Bitcoin rich people who buy blockchain art.
And CryptoCitties.
I find these, and this is the revolt, not, this is a resistance that I felt when I read Mises in the first place and when I read parts of this book, right? Which is essentially that, again, it is a socially Darwinist thinking that says that if you decide in one generation that I am going to stop fishing with my hands and I'm going to build a rod, five generations later, you know, that sort of inequality that is built up is okay. That is not, that it in fact is better and it is moral, because five generations ago, my great, great, great grandfather decided that he's going to spend 2 hours of his day making a fishing rod, and your great, great, great grandfather fished with his hands because he was stupid. And therefore, actually, I am the more intelligent, moral, and bright one, and you deserve your suffering. Like, that is the undercurrent of this. I don't understand how anyone could argue that is not the undercurrent of that. And I think if we had Safadin here or any Mises thinker, they would say, yes, I agree with that, right? And that is a very difficult thing for us, you know, sort of cucked SJWs from liberal college towns to get our heads around. But I think that is what the Bitcoin argument is, and it should always be identified as such, because it is a difficult argument. But if you buy into it, you know, then you're buying into it.
That isn't my primary objection, though I understand your point and I agree with you. I think I'm like too dumb to even get quite that far. Like, I just want a cogent argument for the Austrian School of Economics. And it's troublesome for me when the one time it passes something I know about, it's just some fucking half-ass bullshit where you're like, rap music sucks, Bitcoin maximalism.
Yeah, that was basically it. Yeah, it was just, rap sucks.
Rap sucks.
Mozart good.
Yeah, here's what's wrong with planned economies. You get rap hits, just a bunch of fucking basically, it's like SoundCloud rap is why you should like not manage your economy.
Yeah, yeah. I would say that recognizing a couple more things than you do,
yeah,
that sort of thinking is endemic in a lot of it. And yet, I will say he makes a compelling point. You and I are very pro takes here, right? Yeah. Like, and we don't take shame, and it is a take.
Well, I want to bring this up with you because this idea of politics comes up a lot, and you referred to us as SJW cucks. We're just a bunch of cups out here.
Yeah.
Like, if my own personal politics are going to disqualify me from believing in crypto, then I probably, A, shouldn't buy crypto, and I shouldn't do this show. I'm generally, like, a more curious, don't really give a shit person. Like, so that political disconnect doesn't totally exclude me from it. But I'm interested in what you think about this. So if you hold the viewpoints that you just described about generational wealth, and you think the world is going to hell in a handbasket, there's how the world should be, which I guess is the SJW world.
Well, just an egalitarian world.
But what happens if you think, hey, I want an egalitarian world, but I think the world is actually headed for even less egalitarianness and possibly like tribal savagery and warfare to gain control of the Zappo bunker? What are you supposed to do then? Because I sometimes think the world I want and the world that's coming are almost polar opposites of each other. And part of my interest in crypto is hedging myself against this terrible world that I do believe may come.
I mean, do you feel then that you should morally divest then? Do you feel like you're helping crypto by doing this podcast or even holding Bitcoin then? Because, you know, like the divestment protests that happened in the 80s and 90s across the United States, across the world, about apartheid South Africa and companies investing in them, specifically universities in the United States having part of their endowment invested in South Africa, you know, they would argue that you should then divest from Bitcoin.
I don't feel that way. And here's comes back to what we talked about earlier in terms of, does your government suck? We can argue about whether our government sucks or not. Our government is definitely better than the government of Venezuela. So I don't see crypto as a universal good or bad. It kind of depends where your what your passport says and where you're living right now. And I certainly wouldn't want to deny people in Venezuela the right to crypto because I think it might also undermine America.
But you don't live in Venezuela.
Well, no, but crypto is an international system where if I declare crypto apartheid and try to fight it, I hurt people who are mining in Venezuela.
Okay, follow-up question, yeah. Less serious. we agree that Ethereum world is stupid.
Yes.
Okay. Do we as...
I mean, I'm not even going to go that far. I don't understand it well enough to call it stupid.
No, okay. Aaron is hedging. He definitely thinks it's stupid, as do I.
If you're in an ERC-20 casino, would you be shit talking Ethereum world right now?
Do you think that we should divest from something that we find to be so stupid and whose vision of the world is so bad, you know, that we would want it, that I think that you and I would maybe move to Venezuela instead of living in Ethereum world?
I am cool with Ethereum world. I would draw the line at Bitcoin Cash world. If Roger Ver,
oh come on, that's a cop out.
Gets
that's
any political power, then I'll leave the country.
Okay, I have one more thing I want to talk.
And
about.
And yeah, I have one more thing okay. I want to talk about too.
All right. So while reading about this, I found a fascinating example as to why Austrian, and it was a huge debate in economics. It was one started by Paul Krugman, or was at least pushed forward by Paul Krugman.
Yeah.
And it is a debate between sort of the modern way in which the American economy works and Austrian school economics, and it revolved around, interestingly enough, a babysitting co-op. Right?
Oh, I know about this.
You do? Okay, so the Capitol Hill babysitting co-op, right? It was in D.C., and it was like basically you and I, actually, we both have kids, right? And so I would babysit your kid, and I would give you a thing called scrip. It was their currency.
Yeah.
And I have 20 scrip. You have 20 scrip when we both start. So the idea was if I babysit your kid for an hour, I give you a scrip, and then you give the scrip back to me if you babysit my kid
for an hour. It's
supposed
to be an open market for babysitting scrip.
And the problem is that everyone got 20 at the beginning, so it is a lot like Bitcoin in that there is an extremely set number.
Well, it's almost like pre-mined.
Yeah. It's like an ERC-20 token, right? So they had a certain type of conversion for it. I think it was that each scrip was about a half hour or so. And the thing that happened the second that they released this, right, is that parents decided that they should save their scrip.
Sure.
And that they should be like, okay, I'm only going to babysit so I can save this up for a rainy day when I need to leave for a long period of time. I'm not doing anything right now. And so I might as well not actually go out to this movie. I should take care of another kids who wants to go to the movie so I can cash it into them later. And they instantly had a depression. That there was no demand.
This reminds me of, through a series of miscommunications in which the AMC movie theater chain tried to quadruple charge me for a ticket to an IMAX movie. They gave me 10 free IMAX passes. But they're on paper. And they're in my wallet. Now, an IMAX pass could get you into a regular movie or an IMAX movie. And I was like, fuck this. I'm not going to use this for a regular movie. That's terrible value. So I just let them sit festering in my wallet for years and years until they deteriorated and never used them because I didn't want to like use them for lower value on that. This feels to me like people think that they're going to be desperate and need babysitting. And they are like, well, I want to hoard my babysitting till then. And no one goes off and just casually spends their scrip because they're like, how am I ever going to get it back? Because there's no liquidity in the babysitting
market.
They're
all hoarding. So it was like the beginning of Bitcoin, for example. And they were like, I am not buying that Bitcoin pizza because this thing, you know, at some point I'm going to need this Bitcoin. So I'm just going to hoard it, right? Yep. So there was no liquidity at all in this market. And then they changed the rules. And then they began allowing, when you would come in, you would have 30 scrip. And so they completely screwed up the entire economy. And essentially, they went through like fluctuations of wild like recessions, and like every type of economic problem that went wrong. So Krugman brings this up, and he says, according to Krugman, this is from the Wikipedia page, the key problem is that the scrip's value is fixed. Couples know that each scrip they save in the winter can be redeemed in the same amount of time in the summer, giving them incentive to save because psychologically speaking, each scrip's value is worth more to them in the summer than in the winter. Instead, if the co-op modified the system so that the scrip is redeemable for less time in the upcoming summer than in the winter, there would be less incentive to save because members would get less bang for their buck, in quotes, this is a Wikipedia author, if they chose to hold on to the scrip until the summer. In other words, Krugman is suggesting that the co-op should have had an inflationary monetary policy, right, that the value of each scrip would change. The most common criticism of Krugman's interpretation was given by Austrian Economics, is that the problem is the fixed price of babysitting, not of the scrip, alleging that the correct solution is to let couples decide how much they charge for babysitting on their own. When there is high demand or low supply of babysitters, couples would be more willing to babysit if they are given more scrip for their services. So essentially like surge charging on an individual basis where every single person is Uber. I found this to be totally fascinating, and I found that it really crystallized the difference between inflationary currency and the Austrian idea to me perfectly.
I kind of with them that it's like, hey, I'm a super sitter here. I get 2x on my babysitter.
So as a head of, okay, so you do some co-op stuff, right?
Yeah.
Would you try and become a scrip baron, or would you try and make the system work by actually participating in the economy that it was intended to do?
I used to get criticized when I was a kid because we get Dungeness crab in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And what I would do is I'd get the whole crab and I'd crack it. I don't know why. It goes against my marshmallow thing.
Yeah.
I like to get all of the meat out of the crab first and then eat it, which would mean I was hoarding a lot of the available crab by not eating while people were eating, and then at the end of the meal, I'd have like a huge pile of crab.
Wait, but you all have the same amount of crab.
No. There's the crab's in a bowl. You can take as much as you want. It's as fast as you can chuck.
Oh, so you would shuck them and
shuck before I'd eat.
And you would cut out the eating time.
Yeah.
Oh, you're a dick.
Oh yeah. It wasn't intentional. It's just how I eat a crab.
You're a dick.
It just came naturally to me.
No, I totally understand your interest.
Another great example for people listening that has some of these economic ideas in play is there's an article. I think the guy is named, I want to say R.A. Radford or something. He was in a POW camp in the final months of World War II. And he was a trained economist, and he wrote about the cigarette economy in the POW camp. Which is many of the same things, where it's like people start hoarding cigarettes, and all these people who smoke cigarettes are like, oh no, cigarettes are too expensive for me to smoke now. And then like a guy came around with a cigarette rolling machine, and he just started rolling cigarettes out.
Here's the guy who dumped the wampum in.
He dumped wampum hard. It's fascinating how, like, if it's that how hard to manage a babysitting collective, think about how hard it is to manage a national economy.
Well, but Savadin in his book, he does bring this up, not in terms of this example, but he essentially talks about how there was a copper mine crash after an earthquake in Chile. And that essentially what happened was that the price went way up because access to the copper mines was cut down. And so at some point, because
international copper.
It went up like 6% or something like that. And that if you are in, let's say, like Iceland, you don't really need to know that Chile had a earthquake and that copper supply was cut down. You just start adjusting things because the price of copper went up, and eventually it'll normalize, right?
Yep.
So that's what they're arguing will happen in the babysitter
markets
co-op.
Markets will figure themselves out.
Which is that this market, if individuals are allowed to be themselves, will figure themselves out. The problem is that the babysitter co-op has an administrative thing that everyone had to basically pay script taxes into that would make arbitrary decisions like, okay, now new members have 30 script because we're trying to solve this, and that the entire thing got fucked because the administration had too much control over the actual economy and set all those rules.
Well, even outside of the printing of more script, like even if you take that element out of the story, there's an element to which that economy doesn't thrive because people don't want to be a dick, right? Like, if you're like, hey, Aaron, I'd like to send my kid over to your house here. I got some script. And I'm like, ooh, I'm going to need 3 script to babysit your child. It's just kind of difficult. That would create the perfect open marketplace, but I would have to interpersonally be like, my babysitting services are worth more than anyone else's.
Yeah, but then I feel like even in an open system, that there would be normalizing things that would happen. For example, if you were a massive dick and everyone knew that you were hoarding the script and that you were basically trying to price gouge all the other parents, we just wouldn't go to you, you know? And that we would just trade script among ourselves.
This is like what happens.
You would be frozen out.
This is what happens to me when I play Catan. Do you play Catan?
Yeah, but I hate that game.
I love Catan.
It's like the most overrated
People
game.
Get really mad at me when we're playing Catan because I will very rarely do a one card for one card trade. I want like a 2-for-1. And then eventually people all just get mad at me and won't trade with me. And it fucks up the game when you won't like trade with someone.
Yeah.
But this is how trade really works. It's not just a frictionless, decentralized Ethereum market.
Are you good at Catan?
I'm pretty decent, yeah.
Okay, so does this work for you?
Well, it's a spoiler on everyone if ever.
Because if I was playing you, I would immediately start turning everyone against you.
That is generally, people turn against me quite naturally.
Yeah.
My wife gets really mad at me.
Your wife and I, who are friends, would before the game started, freeze you out. And we would immediately socially pressure the other person playing to not trade with you. I don't know if that's a good theory. Like, I mean, I guess that, you know, the social pressures, I think, do sort of level this stuff out. Now, it's harder to say that over the world economy than it is in a babysitting co-op where you could just say, like, you know, like, Aaron, don't go to Aaron because, you know, he's a real dick about this script thing. It's a little bit harder, but I can understand why you would believe that over time that, you know, all this spreads out and it still normalizes.
The last thing I want to talk about was hyperinflation, which is something he writes about. And he says that there was, since the end of the First World War, shortly after the end of the gold standard, there's been 67 instances of hyperinflation as defined by prices rising more than 50% in 1 month. Now, you and I have never experienced hyperinflation.
No.
Nor do I think we ever will in this country.
No, the closest thing I can think about is like fantasy baseball, like fantasy baseball players or something like that.
Wow. It's incredible to me that you hate Catan but are willing to play fantasy baseball.
I'm really bad at fantasy baseball and Catan. You know, I'm basically bad at all games except I'm pretty good at Scrabble. Like, I think I could probably beat almost every single person that we know in Scrabble.
I'm pretty good at Scrabble, too, and we can settle that on a future podcast. So right now in Venezuela is the most recent incarnation of the hyperinflation. And as I understand it, there is free electricity right now in Venezuela. They have a huge amount of power, so it's not something they're short on. And individuals are crypto mining. People have said almost everyone. I don't know what that actually means.
Yeah, but I find that very hard to believe.
Lots of people are mining crypto as a way to meet their basic needs. And the government is also confiscating miners and supposedly mining.
And they released their own crypto, we should say, Petrocoin.
Yes, they released their own crypto. And actually, ironically, he writes about one of the guarantees of the value of fiat is that you can always pay your taxes in it.
Yeah.
And that was the big selling point of Petrocoin.
Yeah.
Was like, if nothing else, you can pay your Venezuelan taxes with Petrocoin.
Well, that's how the government basically normalizes any sort of currency is that they say you have to pay your taxes in this.
Yes.
Yeah.
That I think that will be when we see true crypto acceptance worldwide is when crypto is an accepted tax form.
Yeah. Yeah.
If it happens. But so you and I have grown up and lived without the fear of hyperinflation, and we're seeing already that Bitcoin is a powerful tool for individual citizens living in a society that's experiencing hyperinflation. Does it change your view on crypto at all that it can be such a powerful tool in the hands of people whose wealth is basically being erased in a month?
Okay, well, let me answer it by answering the question that I asked you.
Okay.
Which is whether or not I should divest from crypto.
Yes.
And I would say that...
I thought you did.
Well, no, I mean...
We had a lot of different stories about
what's
still,
in Jay... First of all, I'm doing that because
Jay's
you got
bag
hacked.
Is just like a massive black hole. You peer into it and you never see the bottom of it.
Yeah, it's a quantum state.
It's like an interstellar when
it's
he
whatever
like,
you think
is
it is.
Floating through time and he sees his daughter's room. That's what's inside Jay's bag.
That's actually pretty true. Like, I actually don't know what's in my bag right now. And that is actually the gospel truth. I have no idea. But I would say that, should I divest from crypto because I feel like these sorts of economic policies and these sorts of politics are bad? And I would say that it is too early in crypto to know ultimately what it's going to be. And that there are many things that have started out with troubling political ideologies from its founders and from its great acolytes that went on to be very useful, you know, and that crypto in itself, I think is completely, well, it's hard to say that it is completely apolitical because obviously it has things baked in, like a deflationary currency maybe can't be apolitical, but it doesn't mean that it has to take over the entire world, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that things can't be built on top of it that are useful, which is something that you and I talk about quite a bit. And so I would say that while I find some of these ideas troubling, I still think it's worthwhile to at least be curious about it. And that's what, you know, you and I basically do here. Like, we find this world fascinating and we're curious people. And so we like to talk about it.
Yeah. I also draw a slight distinction between American politics and the whole world. I don't want what it means for American politics to mean that I can't embrace what it means for the world.
Yeah.
And like a lot of issues, it's going to hurt some people and it's going to help some people and it's going to rebuild the world in a different image. In the same way that war did after this period of money printing, we changed what a lot of the borders were. We changed who was governing what area. I mean, it's a shakeup no matter how you take it. I do think it's important, at least for me, to balance my own skepticism around it in America with how powerful can it be worldwide, because life is pretty good in America.
Yeah. Well, you and I now have been doing this podcast during two inflationary crises.
At least two hyperinflation crises.
One in Venezuela and the other one in Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
Both places had massive spikes in the demand for Bitcoin.
Yep.
It is very difficult for us to be like, well, I believe in an egalitarian world and I don't believe in Austrian school economics because I feel like it's socially Darwinist. And then place those morals onto somebody in Zimbabwe who's just like, hey, the system that existed sucks. And also all this money that I had is gone and I need to do something else about it. And in that way, I think it's very, if Bitcoin keeps evolving because of that, then I feel like it will become much more politically heterodox than what Safedean Amos is arguing, because you'll have a lot of different people making the decision to buy into crypto for very different reasons. And I think that actually is a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, and I actually think that if we asked him, or when he's on here, we will ask him, I think that he would also argue that that is a good thing.
I would say we've been paranoid about the idea that few of these billionaires who are putting money into the Zoppo bunker that has 10% of the world's Bitcoin will become the feudal lords of the...
I don't think that that's wrong.
But... Well, I think that's a real fear, but I just want to put something on the other side of the scale, which is another group that's buying Bitcoin heavily are Venezuelans and Zimbabweans whose life savings are being erased and they're putting it into Bitcoin. So there can be two routes at once. I mean, I still have the problem that those feudal lords are buying like 10,000 times more than the Zimbabweans and Venezuelans, but
10 million times more.
10 million times more, but I guess I just think that there are multiple stories that are happening at once, and I hope on the show we can keep track of all of the stories without just saying, I'm in favor of this or I'm against this.
Yeah, no, and I don't think that our listeners would think that you and I are like politically aligned in anything. I mean, we've talked about the Zimbabwean crisis like in half of our episodes because it is the one thing that you and I keep going back to by saying, in a geopolitical sense, this is the most interesting part about Bitcoin for us.
I also think, as an American patriot...
Are you? From Berkeley, California, damn it. You're going to be like the alt-right guy who like repudiates his liberal past and says, I'm from Berkeley, California. I know how these libs think.
I know a few of those guys. I do think if you are an American patriot, there's this moment in history where the gold reserve, the U.S. Federal Reserve of gold becomes something of an international standard. And the U.S. can more or less print money, then go give that to people around the world in exchange for gold and hold all the gold in the U.S. Federal Reserve and have the fiat currency out there circulating around the world. And that's a power play.
Yeah.
It's a power play and a half. That's like, that may have been peak America when that was happening. I don't think this is a task for America, but it's a task for some country. The first country that does go to a Bitcoin standard and a Bitcoin reserve and does issue money backed by Bitcoin, I think will do very well. Like, I think someone, I don't know, in Estonia out there is just going to go all in on this stuff.
I think it'll be like St. Kitts or something like that, or like, you know, like one of these small island countries.
Yes.
Tax haven argument.
Well, we hear it's like always people islands. Who want to do an ICO and issue money, which I'm just like, fuck, I don't want your St. Kitts ICO. However, if you want to put 100,000 Bitcoin in a bank and then issue some sort of money that's backed by the Bitcoin, I'd be kind of interested in that.
I actually would buy that, but what's the, I would buy that, especially if it's tokenized.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird. Stable coins are generally trying to just be like peg the coin to the dollar, but when are we going to get the stable coin that's pegged to Bitcoin?
Yeah, fair.
I guess Bitcoin is that though.
Yeah.
Am I like, did I just create a logic loop that's now going to fry my own brain?
No, I think what you did is actually too dumb to fry your own brain. You say, why is there a Bitcoin that's worth what Bitcoin is? Okay.
Okay. We gotta stop. We gotta stop.
On that note,
cut that out. And we gotta stop.
Please do not cut that out.
This episode of Coin Talk was taped Tuesday, May 29th at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Bitcoin price index was $7,495.
Thank you for listening to Coin Talk. I'm Aaron Lammer. Laughing at me presently is Jay Kang. Our editor is James Nicholson. Our partner in all this is Medium. Get in touch with us. hi@cointalk.show. Oh, what chapters do you want to do for the next one? Should we do the rest of the book?
Yeah, let's do the rest of the book.
Okay, next one. Next week, we're going to finish the book. And hopefully the week after that, we'll have Safedean Amos in here. So I can grill him about his feelings about the animalistic gruntings in rap music.
Jay agrees with you. I did buy your book. I did buy it. I stopped trying to pirate it. I bought it.
Thanks, Jay. Thanks.